Hey, this is Sean Leary. Welcome back to QC Uncut. Uncut, unedited, uncensored conversation with local newsmakers here in the Quad Cities. Just letting you know, there is going to be a change in regard to the podcast soon. I'm going to be debuting a new podcast called No Cords and the Truth, which is going to be similar. It's pretty much going to be exactly the same as QC Uncut. However, it's going to feature people who are not just confined to the Quad Cities. And one of the people who is going to be a guest on that podcast as well is my guest today. Like how I put in a plug for that, as well as you, the guest, Terry. Yeah. Because he does have not only a national but an international audience for his music. He's extremely talented. One of my closest friends, who is a great guy, Kerry Tucker.
Hi. I don't know what to say to that.
Thanks a lot for being a guest on the show again. So, talking about your new solo album, your first solo album, Undertow. How does it feel to... I know you've been working on this for a while, and you've also kind of, you know... been going through a whole lot of things that have brought you to this point. How does it feel to finally see this come to completion? Are you happy with it? How has the experience been?
It was great. And the main thing that I really loved about doing it as a solo project as opposed to a band thing, not that I don't love working with Einstein Sister, of course, the fact that I was able to bring in so many talented local musicians and make them a part of this as well. It was kind of a long journey. It did take a little bit, and there was definitely some hiccups. But at the end of the day, you know, it's a four-song EP, so... but I'm really happy with the way things turned out. I think it turned out really nice.
How do you think that journey... It has been a long journey, and you've gone through a lot of personal stuff. You've gone through, you know, a lot of different times in your life and transitions. How do you think that that's informed it and helped it to grow along the way and turned it into the work of art that it is now?
I think the main thing at the end of the day that this did more than anything else is it brought me and my son closer. You know, he lost his mom about a year and a half ago, and we did this journey to London together because of the EP, and he has kind of seen more of the process of what I do as an artist and how I put things together, and he's going to be branching off pretty soon and doing his own thing, so I was so glad that we had this experience together, this one last thing to do together as father and son. So out of everything that's happened, that was like the key thing. When I hear the EP, that reminds me more of that than anything else.
Now, I suppose, like, for many people, they're probably like, you're burying the lead here. You recorded this at Abbey Road. We haven't mentioned that up to this point. We're, 3 minutes in, and it's like, I haven't, like, you know, name dropped that. But yeah, so tell us, how did that come about, and how did that ongoing relationship begin? Feel free to, name drop or not name drop, whoever you want to in regard to it. But this involved a lot of really talented people who have worked with a lot of big names.
Yeah. So how it started basically was with Einstein Sister. A couple years ago, I guess 4-6 years ago maybe, we did an album release for Learning Curves. We reissued it on vinyl, and it got some interest in the band. We decided to do a single. And I reached out to a guy named Nick Davis, who is a mix engineer and a producer in London, who's worked... I think probably his most successful work would be the We Can't Dance record for Genesis. He co-produced it, engineered it. But he did the last 3 XTC records, which are great-sounding records. And they were always reference records for Einstein Sister. We'd always bring those albums in when we came to the studio. I'm like, we want to try to sound like this, even though we can't, but we would like to, this is our goal. And so I reached out to Nick and said, hey, we're thinking about doing a single. Is there any chance that you would be interested in mixing this for us? And long story short, he said yes. He ended up doing it. And then he had a friend that mastered at Abbey Road. And he played him the single, and that guy turned out to be a guy named Miles Showell, who masters for Queen, does all the Beatle reissues, does all the McCartney reissues, Bob Marley, The Police, The Who, Amy Winehouse. I mean, he does, like, it. He is the guy. He is the guy at Abbey Road for mastering. And Nick and him are friends, and like I said, Nick played him the single, and he loved it. He agreed to master it for us. And then we did an EP about 3 years after that, which was four songs again. This time Nick ended up mixing it at his home, using some Genesis recording gear from their trucks, I guess, or whatever. And then mastered it again at Abbey Road with Miles. And this time, my wife, before she passed away, she went with me. And we were able to go over for the mastering session then and actually be in Abbey Road and watch it happen. I became really good friends with both the guys. We stayed in touch. And then I decided to start writing some stuff on my own, just kind of a way, a mental break with my wife being sick at the time. And then she suggested that maybe I think about doing a solo thing. And so basically at the end of the day, she left me some money right before she passed that she had hid away for me to take Dylan to Abbey Road just so Dylan could meet these guys, because they were so kind to her during our visit and they stayed in touch with me and checked in on how she was doing, that kind of thing. So basically, I started toying with the idea, and I talked to my friends at Abbey Road to do scheduling, and they started working with me, and I started working with Nick. It took a while. It took us a little over a year to actually get a time where all of us could go over. The recording I did primarily here because I wanted to use so many talented people that live in the area. So I used four different drummers. I used some keyboard players, different vocalists. I did like a choir thing at the RME.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Yeah, you're. Oh yeah, I hear you. You're in there. Yeah, we AI'd you. We can hear you. So I just brought in a lot of local talent. So because of that, I ended up recording most of it here. I did get to play a piano over at Abbey Road, and we hired a girl named Dory Jackson, who's an amazing backing vocalist, and she came in and did some stuff. And then we mixed for 2 days, took the weekend off, and then Dylan and I went back on Monday and then did a day of mastering with Miles. So it was about a 3 or 4 day visit. We did a little recording, some mixing for the first time there. I worked in Studio 3, which is not the big Beatle room where Radiohead and everybody records Oasis. Studio 3 is a little more intimate, but even at that, it's still a big room. It's where Dark Side of the Moon was primarily recorded, Wish You Were Here, Amy Winehouse, John Legend, Tony Bennett. McCartney does some solo stuff there. It's got its own history, but it's pretty classic, and it was definitely a thrill to be there.
What was that like? I mean, take us to, you're sitting in there, like, you, we were talking before we started recording, and you said, like, 10-year-old Carrie would have been just, like, stunned at being in Abbey Road and being, let alone recording there, you know? What was that like for you when you're sitting there, here you are in this just cathedral of music, of legendary music, and here it's you, the same little kid listening to the Beatles records when you were, you know, growing up?
Yeah. So the first time I went was actually about 7 years ago. I went for a seminar, and so I got to spend like 3 hours in Studio 2, which is where the Beatles did all the stuff. And the thing that occurred to me while I was there was that these Beatle albums were not handed down from the gods. You know what I mean? It's like that four men walked into a room and two men recorded and produced with them, and that six humans walked into a studio and a week or two later, or sometimes months later, they came out with these albums. Mm-hmm. And it was kind of, it was a little heartbreaking because it's like, this is real. These really did happen. But at the same time, it was inspiring because it's like, well, yeah, humans did make these records. Men did walk into this, and men and women do this every day. They walk into a studio with songs, and they put musicians together, and they record and produce. And so it kind of inspired me in a way, as well as it broke my heart at the same time, if that makes any sense at all. So that was the first trip. And then the second trip, just being in Abbey Road for a project that involved me, you know, and Miles's office is upstairs, and you can look out the window and see the crossing. I mean, it's literally like right out his window. And so that was a trip. It's like, man, I've looked at that album cover. I mean, I've stared at that album cover so many times, and it's like, there it is. And I'm in the building right now, you know? But recording there was a totally different ballgame, because it's like, this is the one thing I've not done. And I didn't do a ton of recording. I was actually supposed to play a couple of guitar tracks, and then Nick listened to what I did at home and went, no, these are good. We're going to leave these and blah, blah, blah. So I was supposed to play more guitar, but I did get to play a piano. The piano has a ton of history. Floyd used it. McCartney used it. It gets used on tons and tons of sessions. Year of the Cat, it was used on that.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I mean, just super cool. So I did get to do that, and I got to help kind of produce Dory's vocals, and she used John Lennon's vintage Neumann mic that he used to sing through. But yeah, it was incredibly surreal. And, you know, they had a lot of the instruments there that I could play. I was supposed to use originally the Lady Madonna piano, but it was out of tune, so they turned me over to this other piano. The Hammond organ was there that they used on, like, Let It Be and stuff like that. And, you know, it's kind of a museum. Mm-hmm. And they respect that, and they keep the building. Studio 3 is very contemporary looking, but the other two rooms look very vintage, and they like that. They want that to happen. But all the vintage gear is available. Mm-hmm. I mean, the Wurlitzer used on I Am the Walrus is available, and the Vox amps they use are available. They understand the legacy there, and they really promote that, and they make that accessible, which is so cool. That is so, I mean, it's the only place in the world like that when you think about it.
Did that strike you as you were sitting there playing that piano and you're like, holy shit, my hands are touching the same thing that Paul McCartney played all these incredible songs on?
It was weird. I made a joke the other night. I did a release party at Co-op, but I was telling the audience that when I was recording the piano part, which is not difficult, I did miss a note, and Nick was engineering, and he leaned into the talk back, and he's like, did you miss that piano note because of teardrops? Were the teardrops getting... It's like, yeah, kind of, maybe a little bit. I try not to think about it. It's like, I'm here to record. I'm no, you know, I'm not special. I'm just doing a recording session. That's what this is, you know, and I just tried to focus on that. I think it was later when I got home that I was just like, oh my God, what did I actually do here? So I think had I really thought about it while I was there, it would have been overwhelming. Mm-hmm. And there was parts of the day, like we met a gentleman named Simon. Dylan and I met him at the commissary one night. They have a music trivia thing, and we went up and joined them and stuff. And the next day, Simon took us around to Studio One, which is where, like, A Day in the Life Orchestra was recorded and All You Need Is Love is recorded. But it's where John Williams does, like, all the music scores. I mean, pretty much any music score you've heard with a big symphony, it was pretty much done at Abbey Road. And they're putting a new mixing console in, so it was all under construction. We had to wear hard hats. But Simon, like, took me and Dylan through Studio One as well, which I've never been in there. And it was showing me, you know, that's where John Lennon sat, and this is where Mick Jagger was, and this is where John Williams conducts. So, I mean, I got that as well. And then I went back to my mixes, and it's like, gee whiz, you know, it's like, I'm so minuscule part of the history here, but at least my name's on the book somewhere in here, you know, it's like, you know, at the end of the day, it's not going to matter, but to me, at least I know I accomplished this. Yeah. So,
what was it like working with Nick and Miles? I mean, obviously they've worked with these huge, huge names, you know, you think about that and you think, well, these guys are going to be, you know, have an ego to them or whatever. But everything you've told me, they're pretty humble, down-earth guys. What was it like for you working with these people? And what are some things from as a musician and a creator that maybe they were able to impart to you that they're like, oh, this kind of sounds like this? Because they have an encyclopedic knowledge of these things, and that was able to make your project better.
The one thing about both those guys, you know, Miles I didn't meet until after he'd heard what I'd done. I had to audition for Nick. Nick told me when I first emailed him, he said, look, you know, I'm at this part of my career where I don't have to do a project. I'm not assigned by a label or studio to do anything. I just do what I want to do now. And he said, I'm going to have to listen to your band, and if I don't like you, don't take it personally. It's just my personal taste. I prefer to work with Band X instead. And then I really thought that would be it, that I wouldn't hear back from him. And then he responded back and said, yeah, I really like what you guys do. I definitely hear a little XTC in there, and I can hear other things that I've worked on that have influenced you. So I think I'll work with you guys. And to me, that was kind of like, I passed that test, so then I felt like at least he knows what I do, and maybe he'll know what to expect from Einstein Sister at this point. And then we did Farewell Allie Mae on the exit strategies, and Josie Abigail was on it, and I brought in a celloist, and I really did a very delicate job on production on that, and that won Nick over. He just loved that song and played it constantly. He still, matter of fact, when we were at Abbey Road, he played it for the assistant engineer while we were on break. I mean, that really like freaked me out. So I think I have gained his trust as an artist. I try not to think of the fact that, you know, he's mixing my vocal, and he's also mixed, you know, the guy from A-ha, who's, you know, technically a brilliant singer, or Phil Collins or Paul Carrick or whatever. I try not to let my brain go to that. And again, you know, bringing some of the better Quad City musicians, all the drummers I used were fantastic. And you know, it's like I loved... One of my favorite things to do is when we were mixing a particular song, I would watch Nick mix the drum tracks just by themselves, and I would get my phone out and I would send it to that drummer, and I would say, okay, Chris, here's Nick working on your stuff at Abbey Road, your drum tracks, you know. And it's like, this is a guy that you know, the Phil Collins drum sound, that he, you know, helped reproduce that for the We Can't Dance record. It's like, this is a guy who works with Phil Collins constantly, and now he's working on your drums. Mm-hmm. And so I loved sharing that with other musicians and stuff. So that was cool. With Miles, again, because I didn't meet him till after he kind of became a fan. And so that was really nice. The one thing that really freaked me out is when we did the exit strategies, we did it on red vinyl. And I'll never forget this. I was standing there and he said, well, that's fantastic because you did Learning Curves on yellow and the last thing was blue and this is red. And I'm like, he actually plays these, you know, like he's heard this stuff. He actually listened. So that made me feel great because I, you know, they really like what we do. And I was a little worried about doing it as a solo artist, but I tried to keep the quality of work at the same level as what we did with Einstein. And I think that they were okay with that.
Let's talk about how you selected, how you wrote the songs for the album, and then we can talk a little bit about each of the songs, if you would, go through from beginning to end and tell us a little bit about the process of it, what inspired it, how it evolved. I mean, was the song very different from when you first, you know, conceived it to its final version, etc.?
Well, the main thing out of the gate that I was so worried about is lyrics, because I've written lyrics in the past, and I actually wrote a solo album about 10 years ago that I never put out. But Bill is such a great lyricist. He's a phenomenal, like, there's times we're playing a gig and Bill will sing a line that he wrote 20 years ago, and I'm like, damn, that's a really good line. How did I ignore that line for 20 years, you know? So I really was struggling with lyrics. I knew that was going to be an issue, and I just kind of let my guard down, and I basically, after Tracy passed, I just kind of spent some time in the kitchen with an acoustic guitar, and I didn't let, I wasn't worried about the final outcome. It was like, okay, what's happening here? What's the song becoming? And I wasn't trying to get a destination or try to get a finished song right away. I was doing more experimenting with myself as far as like, what if I did something in 6/8 time? Or what if I did something a little heavier? Or what if I go back to an acoustic thing? So just kind of experimenting with different songwriting techniques was one thing I wanted to do. So there's like a track on there that's probably heavier than most of the stuff I've ever written, it just because I wanted to kind of go down that avenue. There's four songs on the EP. The first one is Emily. My mom is in a retirement village now, and I started thinking about some of the women that are there and, you know, how lonely they are, that they lost their husbands or something. And then I've also been thinking a lot about people with mental situations and not being able to cope with things and things like that. So I kind of put those two ideas together and wrote Emily.
Kind of like Veronica by Elvis Costello.
It's not so much about Alzheimer's, but it's just about a woman who's very confused because of a really bad love situation. Because romantic, you know, we all write about romantic situations, right. But they can do a lot of damage. You know, if you get in a bad relationship, it can really harm your psyche. So I kind of just wrote about that. And then Hold Back Rosalie is just about a person who has just kind of had it with this woman That he felt a certain way about her, and she just kind of was insistent about things being a certain way, and he finally just gave up on the relationship. It's Time Bill wrote lyrics for, and it's basically just about kind of moving on with life. And then Undertow, I got the title from my favorite book and film, which is The World According to Garp. They always talk about be careful of the undertow, and they never explain that in the book or the film, so I've always been kind of obsessed with that. Like, what does John Irving mean by that? And then I looked into more of the meaning of it, about being pulled in and sucked in, and it's like just dealing with that in relationships and life and things like that, just trying to stay above. And that became a little more aggressive. I actually had a much more aggressive song that I originally written, and I thought, I want to kind of keep it more in my wheelhouse, I think. So that's kind of where that song came from.
What led you to make it an EP as opposed to an LP, and how did you sort of winnow down to four songs?
We did an EP with Learning Curves. I'm sorry, with Learning Curves, with Einstein's Sister, with Exit Strategies. The single is cool. I love doing the two songs for the single, but something about an EP for me is just really, it's like a sampler platter almost. It's like you get just enough of a band to kind of hear diversity. And I found that really worked well with Exit Strategies, that we had a little bit of everything there. And so I liked that format. An album is a lot of work. An album is 10 or 12 songs, and that's 10 or 12 mixes, so the expense is heavy. And I would have to get at least a week and a half at Abbey Road for that. And mastering is 10 or 12 songs, and 10 or 12 instrumental versions, and those being mastered. And all the musicians you bring in, and 10 or 12 lyrics. And you know what I mean? It's like, it really, just being in a band and doing an album is a ton of work, much less doing it as a solo artist. And I mean, I was making deadlines down to the, I recorded the last keyboard the day before I left to go to London. I mean, that's how tight I was pushing this. Even with a year of recording, writing, getting things ready, prepping things, even with a full year, or the majority of a year, I still was pushing deadlines even with four. So, but like I said, I've kind of become a fan of the EP. It's just a nice little, just enough of somebody. I hate albums that run way too long. I get bored with those. I'd much rather have somebody listen to those four songs and want to hear them again as opposed to being tired of it.
This being your first solo album, but it was a very collaborative enterprise. If you go back to your, when you first started your, you know, music career, you've always been in bands or duos, or, you know, had that collaborative, that person to kind of bounce things off of, and that sort of dynamic. What was it like for you to finally be, I'm a solo artist? Because a lot of times, I mean, people in band, you see this all the time, is like they want to burst out. And they're like, oh, I'm tired of being a band. I want to be by myself and be the person. You're quite the opposite. And you've always kind of been that way, where you've talked about doing a solo record. Geez, but it's been like 20 years we've been talking about this. Now you finally did it. But you, even within the realm of that, you're still very collaborative. What's that dynamic like? And is that uncomfortable for you to be, you know, hey, this is my album, but it's not my album? Talk about that kind of dichotomy between you as a solo performer versus the collaborative works that you've done in the past, and even on this record.
Well, you know, primarily Einstein has been my primary focus creatively. Writing with Bill has become very comfortable. The musicianship and the level of quality from the musicians in Einstein's Sister, I mean, basically these guys are like studio quality guys. Mm-hmm. And when we get to the studio and we record with them, they're just total pros. We work quick. You know, when we get in the studio, I know what to expect from these guys. They're just amazing musicians. But doing the solo thing, the nice thing, as you were saying, is that the fact that I do play in the Dawn occasionally, and I play with the Happy Hours or whatever, Tailfins or whatever.
There's like a ton of bands around
there's
here.
There's a lot of bands. So I know a lot of musicians. And that was the one advantage of doing the solo thing. It's like, I wonder what Chris Cushman would sound like on this track. I wonder what John Hunter would sound like playing drums on that. I wonder what Mike Mudd would sound like playing tambourine. You know what I mean? It's like I was able to, I didn't have to tell these guys what to do, because I brought them in specifically because they're so good at what they do already. Mm. And so that added a little bit of variety. I mean, it's still me at the end of the day. There's nothing radically different from what I do with Einstein's Sister or my role in that band. But that was the nice thing is, like, I had that same comfort zone with all these musicians because I played with them for a number of years, or I played on stage with them a couple times, and I kind of know what to expect from them. And they're all just good people. That's the other thing is everybody I worked with on this project, they're just decent people, and they're good musicians, and they're humble, and they're easy to work with. So that made it nice, too. So
let's go back a little bit and talk about, you know, how you got started as a musician and then kind of go through your career. What was it that first, you know, made you want to pick up a guitar, and what were those first, you know, years like when you were first learning the different instruments that you know how to play?
I had a friend in fifth grade whose mom was a huge David Bowie and Stones fan. And he wanted to play guitar. My dad played guitar, so his mom bought him a little guitar, and he brought it over. And then I'm like, well, if he's going to do it, I guess I better do it. And I had a little interest, and then I got a copy of Rubber Soul by the Beatles. A kid down the street gave me his sister's copy or something, and that was the game changer. I was more obsessed, not so much on the guitar part. It's like, what is about these songs that are so catchy that I feel like I've heard them before, but I've never heard these songs, and what is so different about this from like the Stones or Bowie or something like that? As a 10-year-old, I was curious about the songwriting part of it. So that's kind of always been my focus. Guitar for me is an accessory to help me become a better songwriter. And so I did that, and then I ended up playing bass in the jazz band or the orchestra at school. I got a late start. Their bass player in the orchestra quit, so I was kind of forced in the role, which I hated at the time. But then I had to learn how to read music because of that. And then there was a dinner band, like a jazz show band, that needed a bass player. I was like 12 or 13, and I got this gig, and I was making like serious money and hanging out with cool college guys and going to frat parties and stuff, you know. So that was a blast. So I got to see the kind of the fun side, and you know, and I was making like serious money on weekends as a 14-year-old kid. And then, you know, then the talent shows came, and I started getting together with the kids at school that played and things like that. And then that kind of evolved into a band called Porcelain Tears. Mm-hmm. You can tell it's the 80s, of course, yeah, you know. Right. And John Hunter and Randy Ledbetter and I, and, you know, I still get people to this day that come up to me and like, hey, dude, you played my high school prom, you know. It's like, okay, good.
Where did the name Porcelain Tears come from?
I have no idea. I have no idea. You know, like I said, it was the 80s. That's all I can tell. That's my only excuse.
My late 80s band I was in was called the Abstract Ceilings.
There you go. We probably opened for you guys.
Right, yeah.
During that time with Porcelain Tears is where I met Bill. We had mutual friends, and Bill came to our practice, and we were writing a new song, and I was bitching to the guys that I don't like writing lyrics, and Bill stopped me. He's like, "Yeah, I got a couple notebooks," and that's how that started. So Bill and I did acoustic gigs, and then we met Mike Weindrick, and Mike kind of talked me into the fact that maybe there might be some local musicians who want to do this as a band, you know. And I'm like, I don't know about that or whatever, and he kind of twisted my arm, and he was right, so that worked out great. So
yeah, remember the first weekend I was out after I moved out to the Quad Cities, I went to go see you and Tripmaster Monkey, and it was Douglas and Tucker opening for Tripmaster Monkey at Stickman's.
You sure that wasn't Ribco? I think that
might
was
have been Ribco. Maybe it was Ribco.
Yeah, that was Ribco. That's the night we stole Marty. That was Tripmaster's last show, and it was one of our first shows. And
no, this was before, because it was when Tripmaster were still together, and they were, you know, that was
okay.
A while ago.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so it was like in 93, 94, late 93, early 94.
So it was just me and Bill Acoustic.
Yeah, it was just you and Bill Acoustic.
Oh, yeah. Okay, that makes sense. Sure.
It was before Month of Sundays or any of that stuff.
Okay, yeah, that probably happened then. That probably was Stickman's. Yeah, for sure. So, yeah. Yeah, I've known all those guys. I mean, Chris Barnett used to come in and buy tapes for me, and I worked at Co-op when he was in high school and stuff. So, yeah, it doesn't surprise me at all.
Yeah, because I remember seeing you guys. And then I went to go see Lynn Allen at Chantilly Lace, and Billy Piper swearing at the audience. It was freaking hilarious. Bad examples were at Ribco that weekend too, so that was awesome. Meeting up with Ralph Cover.
You got a smorgasbord of pretty much the entire Quad City area music scene at that point.
And that was great. What was that? I mean, the 90s music scene in the Quad Cities. I mean, of course, like, you know, we've both been around for a little bit, so, you know, you look back and you're like, back when we were, you know, in our early 20s, blah, blah, blah. It was great. But it really was.
It was.
I mean, there's so many talented acts here, and you guys were all signed to like indie labels and stuff. And it wasn't just you guys. It was, you know, Einstein Sister, it was Tripmaster, it was Lynn Allen, it was the Cabalas, it was, you know, Circle Seven. It was, you know, a whole bunch of like the Winter Blanket, like all these other Multiple Cat, all these other really talented musicians that were all out and about playing and putting out really good records too. That was the other thing, is there's so many good records that came out during that time. What did it feel like? And you guys were playing like South by Southwest and, you know, International Pop Overthrow and things like that. What was that time period like for you? And, you know, looking back on it, is there anything that you would have done differently, or are there things that stand out as like highlights that you think like, oh wow, that was really cool?
Well, I Tripmaster must have done South by South.
No, it was Cabalas did.
Oh, Cabalas did. That's right. I forgot about that. Yeah. We did IPO. We did the Pop Overthrow. We did like four or five of those in LA and a couple of Chicago ones and stuff. And those were great. You know, power pop's not like a preferred choice by most music listeners. And so to go out to LA and meet, you know, 40 bands that do what you do, and they're all geeks like you are, you know, and they all dress and listen to the same albums and stuff. Yeah, that was a big boost, because it's like, wow, they get us in Los Angeles. You know, we thought Little Fish, huge pond, we're going to get our asses kicked out here. And then we got out there and started playing, and people are like, oh, we love what you do. And it's like, well, okay, when you have, you know, 10 million people in one city, I guess you're going to find a couple people that like what you do. And I'm not saying the people didn't like us here, but those people in LA were like fanatics about stuff. And so that was cool. I wouldn't change anything. I would not change anything. You know, Bill and I got a publishing deal out of all this, and that worked out pretty nice for us. I have a boatload of memories. I have, you know, even the ex-members, I have some amazing friends. These guys are my family. And that, I could say that about some of the other band members I've been in with other bands as well. Just the experiences I went through with these guys, making these records, playing these shows, and not all the memories are great, but all the memories make me smile. You know what I mean? It's like even the bad experiences we had where we drove in a snowstorm and played for five people, it's like we still have some running jokes about those gigs, and I still laugh about that.
I can think of at least four local music writers, myself included, who consider your album with Einstein Sister, Learning Curves, to be the best local album ever made. Period. I mean, I can think of three other people. I'll keep them anonymous, but who have told me that, or who have said that to you as well. What was it like? I know that album came out of kind of an experience that you weren't completely happy with working with another producer, and so you decided, you know what, we're going to do this ourselves. If this is the last album we ever make, we want to do it our way. And it turned out to be an absolute masterpiece. I mean, it's a fantastic album. I remember that was my number one album of the year when it came out, and you're like, how did you pick us over Radiohead? And I'm like, even you're like, you know, you should have picked Radiohead.
Yeah, I picked Radiohead.
But it was. I mean, it still, like, holds up. I mean, I still listen to that album, and I'm like, man, it's kind of amazing. Like, oh, my friend made this. You know, I remember telling my son that. Like, I remember my friend Kerry that you met. Like, oh, yeah, he did this. And he's like, wow, holy crap. You know, that's really good. What was it like? Talk about what it was like making that album. And looking back, I mean, 25 years later, the legacy of it, and people still referencing it as being a landmark, you know, album in local music history. You know, what is it like looking back on it? How do you feel about that legacy?
John Burek put out a book of like the top 200 essential power pop records, and he updated it about 5 or 6 years ago. So he writes for Goldmine and things like that, and it jumped in place from the first edition, and it's like in the top 100 now. And that was the first time I really took it seriously. It's like, oh wow, maybe we really did pull this off. It's not just my friends telling me that we made a good record and my mom being proud of it or whatever. And that was the, you know, I mean, that's still 20 years after the album came out, and that was the first time I kind of went, God, maybe there really was something to all this. To me, especially, it did start off as kind of an act of revenge. We had made an album in Minneapolis for a label. The producer and I did not get along, and we made an album that, you know, your songs are your kids.
Yeah, right.
And so, like, I let this guy babysit my kids, and they came back, you know, underfed and, you know, not clothed properly, and nobody changed their diapers. You know, that's kind of, that's kind of what it was. And so I was really upset about it. And luckily, I had Bill, because Bill has been so supportive by just letting me take the reins sometimes. And that, like, he just kind of gets out of my way when it comes to certain things. Now, there's certain things, no. You know, songwriting, lyrically, that's his gig. Vocally, that's his gig. But when it comes to kind of organizing or doing things, it's like, Bill, I really want to do this. I want to go to Catamount. I want to make an album, just us doing it this time. And he's like, yeah, okay, let's do it. That Bill is such a great partner to have in a band because of that. That he just allows, he trusts me, I guess maybe is the best way to put it. And so, because we lost so much money on that second record and it was such a disaster for me, I really felt the need to make sure that we made at least one more album that we could be really proud of. And as I've told you before, I remember telling you this, you know, if we sold three copies, I didn't care. I just needed to know that if for some reason I left the earth a little too early, that would be the last thing my name would be on and not that second record. So at the time we made it, though, it was a little stressful on a personal level with some things, but the album was our escape. Mm-hmm. And especially when we worked in the studio, like with Rob Simoresti, may he rest in peace, but we had, you know, I was really becoming close with Rob, and Rob and I just had fun together all the time. And the thing I learned with Rob is recording with Rob is I would play something and I know it felt great, but there might be a little, it might be I sped up a little bit or I had a little clink, you know. Rob's like, well, it's not a groove killer and I love the way it feels, so we're going to go with that. Mm-hmm. Whereas if I'd done it by myself, I'd be like, no, it's got to be perfect. It's got to, you know. And so that album has a looser feel,
yeah,
because of Rob just kind of going, you know what? I like that. I trust that. That feels human to me.
It feels warm.
It does. It feels warm.
It's a real warm, organic.
It does. And I'm going to give credit to Tom on that as well. You know, Tom had us play. Tom Tapman at Catamount had me and Marty and Andy play as a trio, and Bill did like a guide vocal. So we are playing as a band. I went back and redid some of the guitars and stuff, but so Tom made sure that it wasn't just drums, just bass. Just, you know, there's the three of us looking at each other, Bill singing, the four of us are in the room together, and there's that energy. You know, Andy had just joined the band. We had this like fresh attitude. And then to come back and have these fun nights with Rob, you know, staying up till 3 a.m. recording keyboards and like giggling half the night and stuff like that. And you can hear that. I mean, you hear it on the track sometimes in between tracks, you hear us laughing a little bit or kind of snickering a little bit. And so I think that's what it was. It was like, it wasn't this angry album to make. It was, how do we make the best album we can make? That was our best revenge. It's like, don't make an album just to be pissed off. Make a good album and show these guys that this is the album we could have made with you, but you didn't let us make it. So we're going to show you that we could do this on our own. And like I said, if we sold three copies, that's all I cared about. And then we put it out, and all of a sudden it was like, oh my gosh, you know. And like I said, it took me about 20 years. And again, I mean, I appreciate everybody's compliments and stuff. I feel good about the record. I was very proud of it at the time. But when John put that book out, I mean, we're up with some really fantastic records. And the John to notch us up to that top 100, it was like, wow, that's insane. So,
like I was saying, it does has a real warm, organic feel, which sort of almost stands in contrast to today's music and the way that a lot of the digital music, it's precise, but it has a coldness to it because it is precise and all the vocals are altered and everything else. Whereas Learning Curves, it sounds like a Beatle album.
Yeah.
It sounds like Abbey Road. And I remember saying that in my initial review, is this, it has that same kind of, not just because of the medley,
but
just the way it sounds. And it sounds like a band that's happy, that is playing together and is enjoying the creation of this album.
Right. And that's the thing. And, you know, every time I leave Abbey Road now, I keep, like, I remember the first time I went just for the seminar, when I was walking out, I kept breathing in. Like, I'm breathing Abbey Road air. I need to breathe as much of this as I possibly can, to hopefully the creativity. But every time I leave, I'm like, okay, I can die happy, man. I got to do this. And then the next time I go back, okay, I can die happy, man. I got to do this. My total dream would be to get Einstein Sister in Studio 2 to record maybe two songs, to do a single just on that same floor where the Beatles were. I mean, if there's somebody listening that has a lot of money who just would like to see, like to go with us to Abbey Road just to have the experience, I'll let you in the studio. I'll find a way to get you in if you want to pay for all this. That would be the ultimate. Like, that's where I could totally tag out, is to have that band in on that floor, because I know we could live up to it. We work so well together. We play so well together. We read each other's minds, basically. And I know we could deliver the goods if we had that opportunity. I'm not begging or anything. I'm just saying that if that opportunity were to ever come about, I know we could do it. I know we could pull that off. So that's my last, sorry to bother you, Abbey Road dream, is to get the Einstein guys on Studio 2 floor with Nick mixing and recording. So
let's talk a little bit about, you know, something that a lot of people don't recognize is you had a lot of songs on MTV for a long time. Tell us a little bit about how that came about, and, you know, some of the shows that they were on in the background. And because, again, one of those things we've talked about before in the past, and I brought it up to people. I'm like, yeah, you know, there's a guy from Moline who, like, you know, does this music on there. Really? Really? But how did that come about? You alluded to it earlier about the fact that you and Bill were able to get a publishing deal out of the IPO stuff. And tell us a little bit about that.
So we played a gig at Ribco on New Year's, and we used to do these tribute sets. Yeah, I don't know if you remember that. Like, yeah, we do a night of, like, the Police, yeah, or, you know,
Rolling Stones
or, you know, the Bowie or, U2, yeah, or whatever. Yeah. That was kind of an annual thing we did every year. A lot of fun. We always had a blast doing it. And we opened for a band from Chicago, and the bass player owned a publishing company, so he heard us. And we did a 20-minute original set that we blasted through so we could get and do the Police set. That's what we were excited about playing. But he heard that 20 minutes, and he went, these guys would work. This type of music would be ideal for what I'm doing. So he contacted Bill, because Bill actually worked at Ribco at the time, and Bill called me and said, hey, there's this guy that wants to sign us for publishing. And this is right after that horrible experience with that second album. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, man, Bill, these are our kids, and somebody else would own half of this, and blah, blah, blah. And so then he actually called me, the publisher called me and said, look, give me a couple weeks and let me do some things, and I can prove to you that I'm legit and I can make this happen. And I think that conversation took place on a Tuesday, and Friday one of my guitar students called and said, I think I just heard one of your songs on Making the Video with Beck. And he goes, it's on again tonight at 10 o'clock. You might want to watch it. But I'm pretty certain it was, I think it was Jealous Time. And I watched it, and sure enough, there we were on this. I'm like, oh my God, this guy's legit. This really happened. So we talked, and we settled. We got a deal signed and everything. And then when we made Humble Creatures, because what I noticed from the Learning Curve stuff is they always cut around Bill's vocals. Mm-hmm. They use the solos or the intros. So when we did Humble Creatures, I had a separate mix done just of the entire album instrumentally. And we turned that in, and Ken had a field day with that. Like, Discovery Channel and Oxygen Network and HBO and NBC and, like you said, MTV, VH1 especially, all these networks just loved it. Because, you know, we're pretty a non-offensive pop band.
Yeah, right.
You know, instrumentally, that would be good background music, I guess. I never really thought about it in that way. And so, like, there was a show on MTV called Undressed that was kind of a nighttime soap, and they used it constantly. And so that happened. And then I started writing what was supposed to be the next Einstein record. And Bill got married. He bought a house. He had a kid. He went through a lot of life changes really quick. And he's kind of like, I want to put things on hold here. I had already started writing. And I told Ken, look, I've got instrumental versions of this stuff. Can I just send you what I have so you can hear it? And he heard it, and he went, did you do this at your house? And I said, yeah. And he goes, this sounds good, because I worked at Catamount for a year. And Tom had taught me how to properly record albums and make good recordings. And he said, well, Hallmark needs some Christmas stuff. This is like July. And he goes, you know, could you do a couple Christmas things? I ended up doing like 32 Christmas songs. I like went way overboard, and they used them, and then I got this check like a year later, and in the meantime I kept doing stuff, and then these, so I had the Einstein catalog out there. We went back and redid Learning Curves instrumentally, and then I started doing stuff for like Punk'd especially. That was one that used, they used a lot of stuff. And so the beauty of it was that unlike being in a band and going out on road and touring, and you know, my son was 4 or 5 at the time, and it's like I could go to his school play. It was right across the street, so I'd take time off from recording, and then I would just, you know, hop across the street, go see his play, and come back and go back to work and stuff. My only problem is I got kind of burned out on it. I did a lot of it for a long time. It is competitive now because everybody's got Band in a Box and, you know, Pro Tools and stuff. So it's harder to do it now. But I came in pretty much right at the right time and made a really, really strong effort to do a lot of work and stuff. And I'm really glad I did it. So, yeah, that was that's what kind of kept me busy in those off years with Einstein's Sister. So.
The irony, of course, being that when you recorded the Hallmark stuff, your girlfriend left you for a flannel-clad guy in a small town.
She did.
Because you were so busy.
She did. I created the soundtrack for my own nightmare.
Right. Yeah. Honey, I can't get there. I'm in the studio making records. Oh, my gosh. If only I had someone to occupy my time here in small town, rural Illinois. I guess it's going to be you, Josh. You do look good in flannel.
And cardigans. Yeah.
And cardigans. All right. Yes.
Yeah.
But, you know, if you think about it, you were responsible for that relationship igniting. And,
I think so. I provided the soundtrack for the romance, so that's good.
Exactly.
So I feel bad for the other guy. He probably won't talk to me again, but, you know.
Right. Right. So, what else, what would you want to accomplish? Given the fact that you've accomplished so much in your career, what else, I mean, you talked about Einstein's playing at the Abbey Road. What are some other things that you, you know, would like to really have, you know, accomplished, you know, when all is said and done? And also, another thing I was going to say is, what producers, if any, have you never worked with that you would like to work with ideally? Because I always thought, like, Oceanus, I think I said this at the time, I thought Steve Lillywhite would have been the perfect producer for that album.
Yeah. It's weird because Nick knows all these guys.
That's
like,
what I'm asking.
Yeah, like Hugh Padgham's like a big hero of mine. And he's like, well, I called Hugh. I heard a Phil Collins song on the radio a couple days ago, and I called Hugh and said, that sounded fantastic. You know, it's like, can I call him? Can
right.
I talk to him, tell him how awesome he is? You know what? I think, like, oh, my God, yeah, I would never turn down working with Steve Lillywhite. I love working with Nick. He's, you know, his history I know so well, and he just gets it. Oh my God. I mean, everything on the EP, we had one small disagreement on my vocal on the last Einstein Sister EP, and we worked together and we got it figured out, and he was like, yeah, this is better. Okay. This is good. You know? And it's like, he just gets us. He just gets what I'm going for. Like, I hear a sound in my head, and I give him the basic tracks, and then 3 hours later, it's like, there's that sound, only better. It sounds sonically better, but he has the picture exactly the way I hear it. But, yeah, I mean, obviously there's tons of producers I would love to work with. I'm not kidding when I say that pretty much that last goal would be to get Einstein at that floor at Studio 2. That would just be the icing on the cake for me. I've been lucky in a lot of ways. I've worked really hard. I mean, I've played countless thousands of gigs with thousands of bands and, you know, bar mitzvahs and weddings and everything, you know, gigs with guys yelling at me the whole time and stuff. I don't think I deserve anything. I just think that I've worked hard and I've had some good breaks and I've worked hard for some stuff. But, yeah, I think that last thing of getting Einstein at Abbey Road, and if it doesn't happen, oh, my God, I'm not going to complain about it because just I've had the opportunities I've had there, and I'm incredibly fortunate to have that, so I'm good. But, yeah, Steve Lillywhite and Nick Davis with Einstein's Sister at the floor of Abbey Road, too, wouldn't be a problem for me.
So, universe, make it happen. Anything else that you'd like to talk about that we have not touched on in this conversation?
No, this is great. I love this. So I'm not really comfortable talking about myself too much, but yes, you asked me some great questions. So thank you. I appreciate that.
Where's the album's available on vinyl? It's available on CD, any other format. Obviously, digitally, everything is now.
So it's a deluxe package with the CD. The vinyl is on a really cool, what they call cool blue vinyl. Mm-hmm. And that's the four vocal versions. And then the CD has the four vocal versions and the instrumental versions as well. It's part of it like a deluxe package deal. Co-op has it. Ragged Records in Rock Island and Davenport both have it. You can buy it at bandcamp.com for those who live out of town. And then the downloads, you know, Spotify, iTunes, Amazon Music, Apple Music, all that, it's available through there as well.
Tell us a little bit about the gig this weekend. This is going to be dropping today, October 2nd. So you've got gig on October 3rd.
Yeah. So tomorrow night at Common Chord, Josie and Alex are opening. It's pretty much, it is Einstein's Sister with some special guests. I'm going to play all four songs from the EP. And then we're going to do kind of a best of Einstein set as well. And we got a couple surprises we're throwing in there too. So.
Are you finally going to play Putting on the Ritz by Taco like you've been talking about?
No, no Color Me Bad, no Taco. I'm sorry. I hate to disappoint you. So,
Someday. Someday. when you get over to Abbey Road.
Yeah.
Maybe Taco will hear this and he'll say, you know what? I'm going to chime in that, you know, those few shillings for
he'll
the Abbey Road
the
trip.
GoFundMe.
He'll start the GoFundMe.
The GoFundMe from Taco. Yeah.
Right.
Taco, if you're listening.
and we know you are. Gary, thanks a lot for being on the show.
Thank you, Sean. I appreciate it, as always.
And thank you guys very much for listening to QC Uncut. Uncut, unedited, uncensored conversation with local newsmakers. Stay tuned for the new podcast, No Chords in the Truth, which is going to be uncensored conversation with folks beyond the Quad Cities and including the Quad Cities, including Kerry. We'll have him on the show, too. So thanks a lot for listening. I'm Sean Leary. Have a great day.
Mm-hmm.